So welcome everyone to, I'm sure, what's going to be a fascinating session on insuring cyber risk. I'm your chair, Kevin Gomes, and I'll proceed to introduce our presenters today. Our two presenters, rather than three, so one of the three presenters, Peter Yates, is an apology, but our two presenters are Susie Amos and Dean Marcus. Now, Susie is a principal affinity and co-chairs the Institute's Cyber Insurance Working Group. She has a particular interest in the underwriting and pricing of cyber insurance and recently presented at the Affinity Cyber Risk Seminar. Susie looks forward to different specialists joining forces to tackle opportunities and challenges in the digital world. Our second presenter, Dean Marcus. Dean is an actuary at Taylor Fry and a member of the Institute's Cyber Insurance Working Group. He has a strong interest in emerging risks, the challenges they will pose for insurers, and innovative solutions to these challenges. His experience includes valuation, pricing, and analytics for various general insurers over nearly 5 years in actuarial consulting. Now, in tune with the theme of this conference of thinking differently, I will start with a question which I think all presenters at this conference will get asked, which is how their presentation will make the audience think differently. And I'll hand over now to Susie, who'll proceed to answer that question.
Thanks, Kevin. As I said to Kevin earlier, I'm not expecting any groundbreaking ideas, sort of mind-blown as you walk out the door today, but what we are hoping for is just a bit of thinking about how the digital world is changing and how businesses are now exposed to a different type of risk as they're operating in day-to-day life, and how insurers and insurance products, and then on top of that, actuaries, can change the way in which they structure products and the way they think about risk to meet those changing needs. So this might be sort of thinking about holistically about insurance for businesses, or it might be thinking about working collaboratively with other specialists and third-party IT specialists to get the best outcome and understanding of the risk. So, to hopefully we achieve that today, let me just start with the presentation. So today I'm going to talk about insuring cyber risk. The Cyber Insurance Working Group, we got together because it was like-minded people who thought this is a more than emerging area that's taking place, and there's a lot of discussion in media about the risks of cyber in the industry. But as actuaries and as insurers, we probably haven't sort of really come to grips with understanding the risk, how to provide protection for the risk, and even how to model and measure the risk. So we got together to try and sort of pull together some introductory thoughts around what is cyber risk and how you might go about insuring it. We're thinking it's wider than just actuaries. We're thinking it'll be useful for product managers, businesses, and other specialists in the cyber world. And what we wanted to do is bring the attention to Australia. So what's actually happening in Australia? We hear a lot happening about cyber events in the US, but when we bring it to the attention of Australia, what are we seeing here? And our focus today is really going to be on insuring cyber risk rather than the cyber risk itself. So why should you care about this? Well, I mean, some of you may be in the life insurance industry and you think, well, this isn't, you know, this is a general insurance type product, so it's not really that useful to me. But the reality is we should care because the world is starting to care and starting to be impacted by this. Boards are quite worried about it. It sits on the top of any of the surveys that you see, PwC or Aon or other surveys being taken. Boards are really concerned about this and what it might mean for the business. Regulation has started to step up. In the US, it's been around for quite a while, but in Australia, we've been slow to catch up, but we've caught up in terms of the regulation around mandatory reporting. So that's coming in very shortly, and that's going to bring a lot more concern and risk to businesses in this space. But the risk itself is growing, and it's growing because there's a lot more finding value and making money out of cyber attacks and incidents. And it's also growing because businesses are doing more and more online and having more and more interconnectivity in the way in which they work than we ever have before. And so it really becomes an integral part of everyday business and an integral part of the economy at large. So it's quite an important thing for insurers to think about protecting the economy. So what we're going to talk about today, I'm going to start with a bit more about the environment. So what is happening, what's the regulation, how does Australia compare to other countries? We're going to talk about the product and pricing that's happening today and how are insurers responding to it and what might be some of the limitations and issues around that. I'm going to pass to Dean. He's going to talk about data, what information's out there, how you might be able to use it, what are some of the pitfalls, and then he's also going to talk about claims and reserving. So how do you deal with claims and how you might go about reserving for this. Aggregation comes to mind, particularly when you think about some of the incidents that have happened recently. So we'll talk about how insurers might think about their risk of aggregation. And then we'll finish off with a view about the future. So what might that look like? So if I start with the environment, when we think about cyber risk, I guess it's something that's not really too new. I mean, IT risk and data loss has occurred for many years. You know, you can lose things on a CD, on your laptop, and there's viruses have been around for many years. But really the risk is escalating in terms of the financial loss to businesses and it's in the disruption to their reputation and also the ongoing business viability, sort of business interruptions becoming more key. So what are some of the things we're seeing? So you might recall some of the logos that we have up there. There's been just some examples of big names that have had some incidents that have been quite detrimental to their business. eBay, they had an incident where a small number of employee logins were got hold of by someone and they were able to log in quite nicely as an employee and release a lot of information of customer records. 145 million records were released. Target's another one, which is interesting, where their own security systems were fine, but an actual third-party service provider's systems was compromised with one of the swiping machines, and they were able to get in and they lost 40 million of customers' records for financial details, which is quite detrimental, and 70 million of other records. The Target situation is quite a big cost, so it costs them, I've seen online, an estimate of about $300 million it costs them. They were insured for about $90 million, so a pretty big net cost to them. And plus, on top of that, there's a couple of class actions that I think they've settled some of them recently. So that's quite a big impact on that company, a retail company. We've got Ashley Madison, which I can't help but chuckle when I hear about this one, where they think it might have been a disgruntled employee, but they don't absolutely know, who got hold of all of the customer records. And those who are aware of the nature of the business, that's quite detrimental to a number of people's livelihoods. So they've been fined by the government and they have a number of lawsuits that are underway. So I expect that they will end up with a pretty significant cost and a hit to reputation. But the other thing is that it doesn't have to be a malicious attack or a targeted attack. So in Australia, the Red Cross Blood Service, they accidentally released the medical records of people who give blood online, and that was done by accident, by human error, by one of the employees. And so, you know, that's happened in Australia. those of you, everyone probably in the room, had to do the census and are aware of the attack that happened there. That was a malicious attack, and so it's hitting government entities as well and locking down services. NHS is an interesting one where hit a number of the UK, and this is one which wasn't targeted. It was literally just an accidental click on something that spread around all the computers, and so it wasn't a targeted attack, but a ransomware that ended up causing a lot of havoc in the UK. In total, the estimate for the global cost of data breach is estimated to reach about $2 trillion by 2019. So it's a big cost to businesses. So, has anyone ever had this happen to them? So this one makes you want to cry, this one. And this is a virus that the latest one that's come out that's caused quite a bit of havoc. Around 100,000 organisations, 150 companies in the last last couple of weeks. Now, the estimate is that it's cost about $4 billion US dollars at the moment. And this is the one that's simply ransomware that they require the company to pay $300 to $600 to release their information. But the cost of that particular incident is a big cost to businesses, and those watching the news would have heard the NHS had to turn back to pen and paper as a result. So it's something that's certainly coming into focus. But when we think about what we're going to talk about today and where insurance fits in, we've talked a bit about the businesses and how they're impacted. The governments are impacted as well, and individuals are to a lesser financial extent, but probably quite significant in terms of their own individual information. There's a lot of discussions and papers about how businesses and individuals can protect themselves against this risk. So there's a lot of cybersecurity discussions and information out there. But what we really want to focus on is the insurance part. How does insurance fit in, and how does it and should it try and protect this risk and this financial loss to businesses? So when we thought in the working group about cyber risk, it's no surprise that it really should be thought about as fitting into the risk management profile of a company. Historically, cyber risk was probably seen as an IT issue. Hopefully, that's not the case anymore, and hopefully it's considered as part of the risk management framework and risk register, and it's considered the risks are sort of mapped to probability and severity, and protection and mitigation factors are considered. But after doing all that and talking to the experts, the view is that you really can't mitigate all the risks. And to do that, the costs are immense. So there comes a time where you have to have some sort of appetite, or the business has to have an appetite for stopping mitigation and therefore calling on the protection of insurance where they can't mitigate for this risk. So that's where insurance fits in, where all the other mitigating factors can't protect a company. And then part of that is, of course, insurance isn't just the only solution when an incident happens. It's a response plan as well. I guess from experience so far, this tends to be a bit of an evolving area for businesses in terms of coming up with a sound and sort of detailed response plan, but as more incidents happens, I expect this will evolve and develop further. So what does insurance look like? How big is the market? Globally, we have estimated, we've got data, we haven't estimated, we've only got to 2015, but it's global cyber insurance market's estimated to be $2.5 billion. Most of that is the US. A very, very tiny part is Australia. So we've really only just begun, and and we estimate it to be about $20 million now. There's very limited information on it, and it is a pretty small market. But what you can see there is a fair bit of growth that's happened over the last 10 years, less than 10 years. And in the last 3 years, it's been 30% growth. The US has really taken off as a result of mandatory reporting and the increase in the appetite of the business model of hackers and making money. And businesses have really started to take up that insurance. But it's really still in the early days. So just if we think about the legislation that's happened historically, in the US many years ago, 2003, the health insurance breach notification requirement came in. And then over sort of many years, the other states followed. Of course, the US is so disparate in its regulation, it's quite difficult to pinpoint a time. But you can see between 2009 and 2013, if you cast your minds back to the previous chart, that's really where the growth started to happen, was around that particular period. So that really focused the minds of businesses of the risk and the need to protect for insurance. In the EU, it's only been sort of a recent regulation that's come in, and it's expected to be in force in May 2018. So we'd expect a bit more growth happening in the EU. But even though that those regulations have been around for quite a while and there's been a lot of growth in the US, it's still not a lot of penetration. So this figure shows that for the corporate businesses, there's about 30% that buy insurance, and this figure comes from AdviseNet report. And the SME businesses, only 5% penetration. So it's still a massive market to tap into, and still a lot of penetration that can be expected to occur in the US. So when we think about Australia, where are we up to? So we're a fair way behind. We did have a Privacy Act in 98. The My Health Records came in 2012, but really it didn't add a whole lot to the mindset of privacy and even sort of the fines or the regulation around records. But in 2015, it's been a long time coming, but the exposure draft came out for notifications of serious harm. Notifications of serious data breaches. And that's a regulation that has been talked about for quite a while and expected to come in. And we've finally, after many years of trying, it's expected to come in force in February 2018. So this particular regulation is one that requires companies now to report to the individuals and to the Privacy Commission if they do have a serious breach. A serious breach is something that's meant to be at risk of serious harm. I mean, so that's sort of a bit of a legal term, and what does that really mean? Our view is it's a fairly high threshold. So while it might seem, and there's a lot of hype about a mandatory reporting requiring a lot of reporting to the regulator and to individuals, it's a fairly high threshold. So what does the risk of serious harm really mean? If you lose someone's address, is it really serious harm? It's a bit hard to tell, so I expect the lawyers are going to get in and create a view on it and create a precedent. But it is a fairly high threshold. But at the same time, what we think is that this is the trigger for the insurance industry and premiums to start to grow in Australia. And at the moment, we said it's about $20 million. If it takes the same sort of level of growth over the next 10 years as the US did to get to that 2 billion number, then we might get to about 250 million in 10 years, and then maybe in a mature market it might be, sort of using the GDP as a measure, it might get to be the same size market as the financial lines portfolio. So we certainly see that as a trigger, and bringing into focus the need for insurance and to protect these businesses. So what are insurers doing? What does a product and pricing look like? So we have about 20 insurers, we've estimated, in the Australian market. About half of those come from sort of Lloyd's syndicates. The other half are commercial lines, multinational companies providing the product. What you see is no standard wording. It's a new product. We're not quite used to this. It's evolving and it's in its infancy. Some of the policy wordings come from a property policy. Others come from a financial lines policy. Others from a liability policy. So it's quite disparate in the wording and in the trigger. And the underwriting questions are quite varied. So it's clear that at the moment we don't quite understand what is going to drive risk and how to underwrite it. So we see 15 to 50 underwriting questions out there being asked by an individual insurer. If you actually counted up all the different questions, there's maybe close to over 300 different questions. So there's a lot of variation happening in the products. Premiums are very varied. You see 10 times premiums for the same risk happening. And you see at the lower end, at the SME end, you see not much variation happening in premiums. There's a fair bit of gaps in coverage that insurers have intentionally excluded to protect themselves against risk. For example, human error is excluded sometimes. If it's unencrypted data, it's excluded. If it's bodily injury, it's sometimes excluded. Same if it's physical property damage. So there's a fair bit of gaps in coverage. But one thing that the insurers have done is included an extra response mechanism. So if you do have an incident like this, there is a facility to assist you in responding, so be it lawyers, IT specialists, and also sort of reputational specialists. But how does it sort of fit into the rest of the insurance product? This table summarises the where cyber security insurance fits in to the stream of general insurance products. You can see there that most of the typical insurance products doesn't include cyber risk. That's intentional. If you look at a lot of those policies, they exclude cyber risk. I guess I would argue that in today's business world, it's actually a normal part of the business. So there is a question as to whether a continuation of the exclusion should happen, because now businesses have to go about purchasing a separate insurance policy to cover all of these gaps. The insurance policy that is being offered covers the first party and third party. So first party, the physical damage to a particular business and the financial loss around business interruption. The other side is a liability product, so it's sort of a bit of a hybrid product. The liability side, if they actually get sued for loss of data and media liability and security issues. So that's how the market's responding. But what the view is that it covers a lot of gaps. The insured doesn't really understand what it is going to cover or if it's going to protect them. And so there is a way and a world where insurers sort of need to continue to refine and work with the businesses to get sort of the best balance of product for both parties. So when we think about sort of what actually does drive the risk, what should an insurer or a business, if you're thinking about your own cyber risk as an insurer, what do you need to think about? Well, we summarised here some key factors. I'm going to go through them pretty quickly, just in the interest of time, but pointing out a few. So in terms of profile, Industry matters because it might depend on the type of information that you have. So finance, health, pharmaceuticals tend to be the top guys. Size, the bigger guys are targeted a bit more when it's a malicious attack. But what we see now is the smaller guys don't have as good security. And when it's a non-malicious attack, they're actually more susceptible to an event. So even small companies are at risk. Records is a good exposure measure to think about, but probably more so the records that are personal information and private information. Whether you're online and geography, outsourcing are all key things. Mitigation factors there, really high level, is think about governance and think about your physical IT as to how to mitigate these things. And all of those things are sort of a starting point of pricing and underwriting for cyber. But the hard thing for actuaries is, well, how do we do this without data? It's a pretty new product and there's not much around. So I can't answer that question, so I'm going to get Dean to answer that question.
Thanks. Before I answer that question, I'm going to share something personal that was too well-timed for me not to share. So I woke up this morning in a nice hotel room to an email from Zomato, which is Urban Spoon, saying there was a data breach a couple of days ago. 17 million people have lost their names and email addresses and possibly their passwords. So I thought that was pretty interesting, and it was not a great way to wake up. One of the other really interesting parts of the email was they said, make sure you have a strong password that is unique to each service. So I think I'm pretty smart in some ways, but I can only remember maximum 2 passwords, and I have maybe like 300 different places where I need to make a password. So this highlights the prevalence of these risks and the fact that it's happening all the time. Everyone is losing their data all the time, and it's a very difficult thing to protect against. So that was irrelevant to my part of the presentation, but now I'll go through some points about data. All right, so firstly, my interest was not immediately in the data relating to cyber risk, but rather to pricing. And I was thinking, well, what data would be needed in order to accurately price cyber risk? And reserving is kind of a similar question. So on the data that's available, there's actually quite a lot of data available, but it's mainly aimed towards IT security firms. So, for example, management consultants around the world, they do these surveys of businesses themselves as to what measures they have in place to protect themselves against cyber risk, and the kinds of vulnerabilities that they see as the main concern and things like that. But that's not entirely relevant to insurers. So what insurers would like to get is details about claims handling, costs and processes. And at the moment, that's fairly unavailable. A couple of other points here is that there's a lot of data about the threats themselves. So firms like Symantec and McAfee, they very often release notes about the most current threats and the ways to protect against them. And another really interesting piece of data, at the bottom in the middle here, is a screenshot from a website where you can actually see live DDoS attacks happening around the world. So a DDoS attack is a denial of service attack, like the one that happened to the census, where basically the website or the server gets overloaded with requests and then it just crashes the server so that it can't operate. So what these websites show you is they've got a big map of the world and you can see where the packets are being sent to and from, and it's quite interesting, but again, it's not that useful for insurers. And so the final question here is, where is the data about the paid cyber insurance losses? So to give you an idea of what is available that's probably most relevant to insurers, we think that the main source would probably come from these 3 surveys that are out there. The surveys are mostly based in the US, but one of them is Australian. So the one that covers both regions is called the Poneman survey, and then the other two are Net Diligence and Verizon. So what these surveys tend to do is they ask a bunch of very big businesses about their historical losses relating to cyber incidents. So the important part here is these are still surveys of the businesses as opposed to the insurers, except Net Diligence actually does cover a bit of insurance. But to give you an idea of what's covered, it splits all of the cyber losses by industry and size. And then it also splits it by the cause of the loss. So there'll be some discussion around those losses that were caused by internal leaks or by negligence. Then there'll be a split discussion about the external attacks or incidents. And then further, they'll split those ones by the cause of the actual attack. So there'll be malware, phishing, and all the other kinds of causes. And the stat that is mainly of interest for them is the average loss for an incident. And again, this is just from the business's perspective. So then after they cover the loss details, and typically they just give an average loss dollar amount, depending on what split you're looking at, they then also focus on things like the lag between the event and the identification of the event, and then the lag between the identification and the neutralization of that event. So some comments around the data that will be available for insurers is that the mandatory breach notification laws, they'll have kind of a double effect where, on the one hand, they're going to increase the consistency and potentially the availability of data, but on the other hand, they're going to change the claims profile quite significantly, and it might make a lot of the historical data a little bit irrelevant, or at least less relevant. Some general caveats about this data that's available. So, as I've already said, the events are the breaches from the business's perspective rather than the insurance claims, so that makes it a bit less useful. It doesn't necessarily cover all perils. The comment about historical data maybe not being useful, as the threats keep on evolving, how useful is it to know what a phishing scam cost 10 years ago compared to what it's going to cost now? And the last point is that very few breaches are reported at the moment because there's no mandatory notification requirement, but that might change into the future. So some more technical kind of biases and limitations in the data. So the first one is that the samples that these surveys use, it's usually around 20 very big businesses in the States, so you can imagine that that's not going to be statistically representative of Australian businesses, let alone the coverage that a particular insurer wants to offer to its policyholders. There are no error bars in this data. It's really just like an average claim size in a particular dimension that's been split for the data. And also it's not Australian data usually. So that's kind of a comment around the small samples. Then there's reporting bias, which is that these companies are not forced to disclose the events that have happened. They're not forced to disclose accurate information either. So you'd imagine that, firstly, some companies just won't be part of the surveys because they don't want to reveal all of these very high claims costs, or maybe particularly low claims costs that they don't want to reveal. Sorry, not claims costs, but breach costs. And what else is there? Right, that's the main thing about reporting bias. Then the lacking detail is also a very important point, and it relates to what Susie mentioned before, is that the drivers of costs are often things like the IT security measures that are in place. And these surveys don't ask detailed questions about the IT measures that are in place for each one of these companies. So one split they do relating to IT security measures is it a high security environment or is it a low security environment? And I mean, that split is fairly artificial. How is it going to help you figure out expected claims costs for the purpose of pricing? It's probably going to be completely useless. And the last point I've already mentioned. Okay, so that was all of the things that we found out about data and about whether it's available and what the issues are relating to data. And now I'll quickly move on, because I think we're running out of time, but I'll move on to claims and reserving. So what we've got here is a typical timeline of a claim from an insurer's perspective. Now this one is focused on a claim where there was a data breach of personal information. So the event, the ransomware attack within the last couple of weeks, that's completely different, where the computer was locked. They're actually given a deadline of 6 days or something to pay the money. So that isn't quite representative of this timeline, but what this focuses on is more the large data breaches of personal information. So in the first few days, you are required to notify the insurer. And one really interesting point about this, and it came out recently in the ransomware attack, is that if these companies try to address the ransomware before notifying the insurer might reject the claim. So it's sometimes part of the condition that the insurer needs to be notified and be involved in the process of remedying the attack. So in the first few days, notify the insurer sends a response team, and of course the company itself is going to be working on re-securing its IT systems and trying to get the data back that they may have lost. In the first week, the aim is to just neutralize the attack or the incident. And as part of that, the insurer is going to be involved in sending legal investigation teams and trying to check if it actually qualifies for a claim. And also in the first week, it's generally advised that they initiate discussions with PR consulting firms to try to ensure that the crisis is managed as best as possible, or rather that they have a good plan to manage the crisis. So in the first month, the PR plan should be in place and it should actually be implemented. The regulator needs to be notified. So the important point about the regulator for the month mark is that this new Australian regulation actually says that you have 30 days to assess whether or not this breach caused or is likely to cause serious harm. So I think what we're going to end up seeing is that it will be the 30-day mark that these companies actually disclose that the event happened. Then the insurance investigation is taking place within the first month, and a rectification plan is also in place. So that's just getting all the data back, securing the systems, making sure that the same event doesn't happen again. The 3 to 6 months is basically just finalising claims. I think that's the essence of it there. And there's more internal work to be done about securing systems and upgrading and so on. One other point about this longer-term time frame is that the police might be involved in investigations, and their involvement might last quite a bit longer. And also, there'll be monitoring of the personal information that was lost, and whether or not there are things like credit card frauds taking place in the long term. So that's if people's credit card numbers were lost. So that credit monitoring needs to continue for quite a long time. All right, so now a quick point on claims handling. And although, well, I, as a consulting actuary, I happen to not think enough about claims handling, I think, but this is a point that really speaks to the topic of the conference, which is thinking differently in a way that I probably wouldn't have thought of beforehand. So the way that cyber insurance is changing the view on claims handling is that there needs to be a very strong integration of third-party support and third-party legal and IT types of services. So that came out in that previous time frame that I gave, where very soon after the event, the insurer should be sending forward a response team to assist in the mitigation. So that's one point where it's a point about thinking differently, where it may not have been the case previously that insurers need to really be integrated with these third parties, but that's becoming more important. So the other point that I think causes insurers to think differently is that the cost of investigating the claim is so high in some cases that covering small businesses can become not feasible at all, because the claims cost can be completely dwarfed by the actual cost of investigating whether or what the cause was and how the incident, whether or not it's covered. So as a result of that, there's this big question around whether this model of investigation costs being very high, whether that's scalable to small businesses at all. And this is leading insurers to consider the prospect of offering an all-perils cover, so one that covers not only cyber, but also covers property and liability and so on. Because if that's the case, then the insured will know that they're going to be covered pretty much regardless, or rather that there will be less investigation required. And so the investigation cost will decrease as a proportion of the claims cost. So this idea of potentially offering an all-perils product, this I think speaks to the theme of thinking differently. All right, so here's just a little graph about the proportion of claims cost in each head of damage over the last few years. And you can see there that the top two, lost business and investigation, are the main parts of the claim cost. And investigation was the one that I was mentioning before. So one other thing that comes out to me here is that notification, the light blue one near the bottom, has actually been decreasing. So this is Australian data. Notification has been decreasing as a proportion of the total. Maybe the actual dollar amount is going up, but as a proportion it's decreasing. Although we think that that's going to increase very soon, because in February of next year, this mandatory notification bill comes in. So we think that might go up. But regardless, the message here is that lost business is a huge cost, and that was the cost of the ransomware. Like, the ransomware itself, you pay $300 and it covers it. Whereas the actual $4 billion estimate of worldwide loss was mainly to do with business interruption. And investigation is the problem, really, for insurers, I think. All right, moving on. Nearly done with my part. So what do we know about... Oh, right. Reserving. So there are some challenges about reserving. It's still early days, of course, and I'm sure you'd imagine that the techniques for reserving are going to be quite simple. The challenges on the left there is that the policy wordings are not consistent from insurer to insurer. The data is out of date almost immediately if the threat keeps on evolving. And, of course, there might be some potential for claims coverage to overlap between different policies. One example of that I'll just not really draw up but mention is if you suppose that there's a car park and the car park systems are hacked, and then a boom gate falls and hits someone on the head. And then there's this question, who exactly is liable? What cover? What insurance product is going to cover it? Is it a liability claim? Is it cyber? And so on. So there are very clear potential for these overlaps to take place. Now, there are lessons that can be learned from similar classes. I think the main one would be D&O, because around the GFC, there were huge changes in how D&O claims played out, and that was because of the precedents that were being set, the legal precedents. And we expect that to happen in a similar kind of way with cyber, especially as Susie mentioned, this requirement for it to be likely to cause serious harm, that's going to really be defined during these legal kind of followings. PI, the other one, so PI and medical med-mal, that's relevant because it requires a proof of proximate cause as well. So for cyber, that proof of proximate cause is part of why there are these investigation costs, so that's similar. And liability has obvious similarities. So what do we know now? One big point is that these breaches or these events can actually be latent for half a year, and this is the average time that was seen in one of the surveys, was that it takes around half a year for them to actually find that their systems have been hacked in a particular way. So this should ring alarm bells for IBNR, where if you're trying to build some kind of reserve, you've got to be thinking, all right, well, maybe we know about some of the things, but there's half a year of events that we might not know about at all. The other point is that first-party heads of damage, so things like business interruption, they're relatively easy to estimate because they've been done for other lines of business. It's quite easy. But really, it's the third-party losses, so these data breach events where personal information is lost, they are quite difficult to estimate. The surveys that I've mentioned can help, but again, there are lots of limitations that I tried to describe around those surveys. Penalties, regulatory penalties, they'll evolve over time, and legal precedents will help to set and figure out how much those are likely to cost. So the methodology we're foreseeing, is that it's going to be very simple. Case estimates are going to be built based on IT security involvement and assessments, and then it's probably going to be some kind of loss ratio times unearned or earned premium to figure out the other values. One last point on reserving is that in these surveys, their stat that they focus on is the cost of a data breach, and then they often give the average cost per record breach. So if it's a hospital and there were 500 patient records lost, they'll say, all right, the loss was $1 billion, so the average cost per record was blah. I wish I could do it in my head quickly, but I can't. And the warning that we're giving here is that it's not a good idea to wed yourself to an average cost per record breached, because it actually doesn't scale that way. So what turns out to be the case is if there are lots of records being breached, then the average cost actually tends to go down per record breached, whereas if there are very few, the average cost tends to go up. So the point is, this is not a good approach to reserving for cyber. So that's all for me on data and claims and reserving. I'll pass back to Susie to finish up.
So we're running short of time. I'll skip over aggregation and scenarios, but just really just finish off so we've got some time for questions about the future. Just to summarise that mandatory reporting's coming in. It's going to give a new focus to businesses about cyber risk and the uptake of insurance. And the insurance world is going to need to evolve and grow and change to meet the needs of businesses in the digital world. So that's really going to be about looking at different products and collaboration with different specialists. So I might just leave it there so we have got some time for questions, if there's any.
Thanks, Susie and Dean, for a fascinating talk. So the floor is open for questions. We have a few minutes, and if anyone would like to ask a question, please find your way to that microphone, and I just ask you to say your name and the company for the recording purposes.
G'day, Bruce Lambert from AMP. You talk about pricing and, you know, there's not much data and it's all averages. The world's moving, probabilities, etc. Target, you know, was insured for $900 million, had a claim for $300 million. So how do companies estimate how much insurance to buy, let alone price it? How much do they need to buy in the first place?
Yeah, look, that's a good question. I might try and answer that. I have been asked that before as well. Look, I guess the way in which I think might be a useful way to approach it is to think about a particular company's risks like you would with normal insurance. Are they exposed online? Are they exposed to different countries? Do they hold financial and personal information? And then sort of look at the risks and the mitigation they have around that. And then in my mind, I see using the information that we do have a view of likelihood of a particular incident happening given those particular measures, and also a potential cost. And so how might you come about those? You know, it sounds all nice in practice. I see it as an exercise where you're going about a sort of a stress test scenario, and you sit with a group of people who from different areas of the business and also IT specialists, and you come up with a view of, based on historical experience, what the probability might be and what the severity. And then out of that, I see being able to sort of say, well, we're willing to accept this risk, but we're not willing to accept this level of cost. And so using that to estimate a level of cover. But I would say at the moment, insurers will only offer a certain amount. Like they're only offering sort of 10, 20 million, and then bigger companies, they tend not to go beyond 100 million. So even if companies might want the cover, it is a little bit difficult at the moment to get it.
If I could just ask a question, Susie, which relates to that question. You didn't get to talk to your slide on aggregation of risks, but it seems to me like this cyber product would certainly have the potential for very large aggregation of risks, which insurers would need to be concerned about. Is there a role for reinsurers in terms of that?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really good question, and I think, yeah, reinsurance is the way to provide some protection to the new players coming into the market and the concern around the aggregation of risk. Some of the examples are up there, but, yeah, you can see that there is a potential for escalation quite quickly. At the moment, insurers are minimising their layers and also you'd expect them to start thinking about concentration to particular industries. But then ultimately, reinsurance is going to be the protection around this, but it'll be interesting to see how that plays out and what sorts of claims come through in that regard.
I think one other interesting point on that is that it will be quite difficult for reinsurers. Yeah, it will be quite difficult for reinsurers to assess the risk inherent in each insurer when the insurer's coverage and wording varies so significantly. So it's just another point that the challenges are really, really high, and that they're there from all perspectives, really.
Yeah. So insurers need to think about how they can balance the risks and the aggregation and but still provide a useful product and coverage to businesses.
Okay. Any other questions? not. We'll probably get herded out of here shortly. So, no? Okay. If not, I'll... If you could just join me in thanking our presenters, Susie and Dean.